Hello, and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast and impatient world. I'm your host, Carl Honoré, and today my guest is William Powers. William has spent a couple of decades working in development aid and conservation across the developing world, Latin America, Africa, and North America. He's also been a writer, still is a writer of essays, and has done commentary on global issues. His work's appeared everywhere from the New York Times to National Public Radio. He's worked for the World Bank. He's also spent, I guess, along the way, a couple of decades contemplating and writing about the American obsession with speed and looking at alternatives. His books and articles on that subject have appeared everywhere from the Washington Post to the Atlantic. He's a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute and also an adjunct faculty member at New York University. We're talking today with William Powers because he's published a book called New Slow City. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks, Carl.
Now, I love the title. As an author myself, I know that it's a difficult thing to get a title, and I thought it might be an interesting place for us to start. How did you come up with the title, New Slow City?
Well, you know, I'm from New York City, and it was just sort of a pun on New York City, New Slow City. It just seemed to flow well and capture also the idea of it being this part of this new trend.
And of course, the slow is the key here, because you went into New York City, one of the fastest cities in the world, and planted a flag for slow. Maybe you could just set up the experiment that led to the book itself. Why did you go into New York City to do this, and what was it all about?
Well, we were already living in New York City, my wife and I, in a 1,900 square foot townhouse in Queens. And at a certain point, it just seemed kind of too big and too cluttered with, you know, 3-4 bedrooms and lots of stuff. And also, we were experiencing a kind of a time poverty where, like a lot of people listening to your show, just overscheduled, overextended, you know, not enough time together. And at a certain point, we decided to kind of just make a radical step. And we got rid of some 80% of our belongings and downsized to an apartment 20% of where we'd been living to a micro apartment in New York City. So it was 340 square feet. And to do that, we had to really simplify and think of it as a ship that you kind of equip minimally. And also, I scaled back from a kind of a workaholic lifestyle of, mm-hmm. you know, speaking events and writing and consulting and teaching to a 2-day work week as an experiment in giving myself more time to just do other things and, quite frankly, also just to be.
Now, I was fascinated by the apartment, inspired by your earlier book, which was called 12 by 12, where you lived in a cabin that was that size, 12 feet by 12 feet, correct?
That's right.
North Carolina. I remember one of the descriptions in the book, in New Slow City, you talked about how you couldn't even shut the bathroom door while you were sitting down.
Right, that's right. So I'd lived in a 12-foot by 12-foot cabin off-grid in North Carolina for a season, and in some ways, and that's what inspired my book, 12 by 12. And in some ways, I wanted to bring back some of that minimalism and time richness that I found there. But, you know, it's one thing to do it with No Name Creek ribboning through your permaculture orchards in beautiful North Carolina. It's quite another one to be in the middle of a impure polis like New York City, living 12 by 12. So, you know, not only couldn't you close the bathroom door, but to take a bath, you had to actually put your feet up the wall in a kind of a shoulder stand position. And we would constantly be bumping into each other at first. And it was almost impossible to, like, cook at first, because how do you find counter space to even cut onions and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm interested by the fact that you chose New York City. You're obviously from New York, so there's a natural pull there. But why take slow into the fastest place, or one of the fastest places on Earth, to begin with? Why not start smaller and more modestly and maybe try and live slow, with a capital S, in a mid-sized city in the Midwest?
Well, one thing is, New Yorkers have 1/3 the carbon footprints of the average American and walk several miles a day on average. So there is a kind of carbon intensity to being in a city, and it's a lot of ways more ecological with all the public transport and so on. It's also a very dynamic city and very exciting, and quite frankly, so much to do and enjoy, as anyone who's been to New York can say. Also, you know, I'm from there, and my wife was working at the United Nations at the time. And so, you know, sometimes you have to also and be part of a couple and do what your wife is doing. So there was a side of me definitely that wanted to decamp at that point to somewhere smaller and slower. But in a sense, like many people, we had to make it work in the molten core of global capitalism because that's where the employment was.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm a huge fan of New York for the reasons that you've just listed there. But something that always strikes me about it is how urban it feels and how little green space there is compared to, for instance, London, which is another big volcanic global metropolis. But you managed to ferret out and find little corners of nature in and around the city and nearby, didn't you? Was that something that you knew just growing up there, or does everybody know those things and because I'm not a native New Yorker, I don't find them when I go?
Well, definitely as a native New Yorker, you know more of those corners, but honestly, really when I started to find them was when we scaled back to this slow year in Manhattan. And you know, places like the edge of Pier 45 in the West Village, where you can't hear the highway anymore, and you just, you know, the water lapping against the pier, and just you feel like you're out on the bayou in Louisiana or something. And the other one would be, you know, the Ramble in Central Park, where the paths kind of wind into each other, or Chinese decorative arts in the Met, you know, these little corners where nobody goes. So, you know, we start to call those urban sanctuaries, these places where at least once a day, and I recommend wherever you are, just spend even 5-10 minutes a day finding some urban sanctuary to kind of like get centered and feel peaceful in.
I definitely felt, I mean, I enjoyed your book immensely, but I also feel I might take it along next time as a travel guide to seek out some of those sanctuaries myself on my next
visit. Some people actually have been doing that, that, you know, a lot of the places I mentioned really aren't in guidebooks, and people are kind of going to those various sites.
Does that kick up one of the inevitable paradoxes and ironies of slow, that by slowing down and by identifying places that exude good slow, lots of people then go to them and they cease to be slow as they had been in the past?
Well, it's possible. But then again, if you know, books like your book, In Praise of Slowness, and mine and others inspire people to sort of think differently, act differently, and be slower, you know, it's sort of creating a slower culture. So I'm not as worried about that.
Let me ask you about the actual practicalities of living slow in New York. What did you find hardest? What were the most difficult challenges?
Well, one was, you know, living in this tiny micro apartment. There was no gardening space, obviously. And even in our Queens townhouse, we did have a nice backyard garden, which was lovely to be growing 30 types of vegetables in the city. So that was one sacrifice. But otherwise, you know, we discovered our roof on top of our building, which wonderful way to open up to the fast-moving clouds in the sky, you know, and the pigeons, fledglings, their little babies on the fire escape across the way, and everything else, you know, this sense of being like outside in the city. The roof is one of the forgotten spaces of cities that people, you know, in our entire year there, we never saw a single other tenant in the building on the roof. And yet we were up there every single day.
Maybe a good place to go now is to ask you what your definition of slow is, because I think maybe slow means slightly different things to different people. So when you went into New York City and said, I'm going to live slow, what did that actually mean?
For us, it didn't mean doing nothing. As others have said, you know, going slow all the time is really not what we're aiming for here. It's finding more of a self-paced life. So in some ways, I was aiming for qualities like, you know, attentive, receptive, patient, instead of like this rushed, harried, you know, urban feel that you always have in New York. So in one way, it was the inner slow. It was like the state of mind of just being joyful and happy and in the present moment. And the other part of the definition had to do with creating more time in my schedule. So we did not want to have constant back-to-back meetings and appointments. So I really did limit my week to 2 days a week of very efficient work. So I was working basically Tuesdays and Wednesdays, full days, and then had five-day weekends.
And once you took that definition of slow into New York City, what was the biggest obstacle? What were the hardest challenges you faced in putting it into practice?
Well, they say that you don't change the culture, that the culture changes you, in a sense. So when you're in this culture of speed and more and fast and efficiency, at first it's quite a detox period. So, you know, I had a hard time kind of adjusting to being kind of alone. I found myself alone at first. But what I discovered was, you know, when you do slow down, after a while, you start to see all the slow things happening that you didn't see when you were going so fast. So some of those were the musicians in Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village, who it's called the Jam. They get together pretty much every day during the warm months and just play wonderful music and just hanging out with them. And one of them said to me, you know, I work 24/7. So I said, wow, that's a lot, you know. I said, no, I work 24 hours a week, 7 months a year. You know, that was the definition of a schedule.
You mentioned being alone as part of the detox or the kind of maybe withdrawal symptoms that you went through at the beginning. And I guess that's one of the things that people confront when they slow down and move out of that distraction mode. What was difficult about that? Was it the fear that you were somehow getting left behind, that you weren't making enough of your time, or was it some bigger metaphysical questions about, you know, being alone and having to face your inner self, I guess?
Well, not so much the latter, but more that there's a bit of an inner voice that says, look, everyone's rushing around drinking their coffee to go because they're, you know, part of this system and they're achieving and getting ahead and so on. And what am I doing sitting just enjoying a cappuccino for an hour and a half in this little shop? You know, you kind of feel like you're out of it in a way. And that's a shame because, you know, all of the time-saving devices that we've created over, you know, so many decades were supposed to be actually saving us time, freeing up a kind of a leisure dividend. And it's just shocking that even though labor has become three times more efficient since the 1970s in the U.S., we're working considerably more hours. So where is all that efficiency going and where does it end? So I think what happened was just by slowing down and forcing myself to be kind of countercultural, it really changed me. And I would say that loneliness didn't really last long because you find these deep inner reserves of joy just from being in tune with your natural rhythms. Even as a creature, as you know, Homo sapiens, we've lived for 99.9% of our evolution without the clock, as you so eloquently write about, you know, the hegemony of the clock and clock time, industrial time. And I just got into a space where I was just very satisfied. You know, it's like the poem from Camus, you know, The Physics of Happiness, time in the open air, love for another being, freedom from ambition, creation. You know, so I found something about the freedom from just the ambition of everyone, you know, and the creation part. So then when I was working and my 2-day work week didn't last forever, I actually increased to a sweet spot of about 32 hours a week of maximum efficiency. But when I was working, I was able to find that creativity out of my own inner voice and setting my own schedule rather than these imposed deadlines and rushing around.
Because you were changing gears, you had times when you slowed down and you sped up when it was on your terms, I suppose.
That's right. It was this beautiful balance between, you know, sometimes going fast.
Mm-hmm. You talked about being alone and then finding those deep inner reserves. But the kind of slow that you encountered, it struck me, was not in any way a selfish, solipsistic, me kind of slow. In fact, what you discovered and unspooled in your journey of slow through New York City was that you connected with other people and you created these networks of like-minded folk or just other human beings that you crossed in your day. And it became about us, in a sense, connection with others, service to others. And it felt like there was something bigger than just slow as a lifestyle choice to be happier, have a better body, and maybe be a more productive turbo-capitalist.
That's an excellent point. I did find much more community and real connection, you know, like the poem says, love for another being through slowing down. And that was maybe a surprising aspect of it, that just from the very superficial connections, like the guy who sells fish in front of my apartment, who you would just breeze by before no one notices, just to like kind of like recognize the beautiful fish that he's selling each morning and talk to him and suddenly like open this relationship with people, that their spirits suddenly feel void because they've been noticed and seen. Mm-hmm. And then also to relationship with my wife and friends and family and so on, just everything's about time, you know, and what's the opportunity cost of all this ambition in terms of the quality and not just in terms of like my direct tribe or family, but also, you know, I found myself extending out civically a little bit into the city more because I was volunteering at a large rooftop organic farm over in just across the bridge in Queens, and also, you know, involved with 350.org, a local climate change group, and so on. So, you know, you also have time for those types of group activities.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a bit of that old Gandhi phrase of be the change you want to see in the world. In a sense, you were doing that, weren't you? Because by slowing down, you were creating a ripple effect in the people around you, the community around you, the city around you?
You know, in a small way, I definitely found that. Like I mentioned, the fish guy, he definitely, his day was brightened, and then he'd be sharing that with others. And then the fact that it wasn't just the selfish me ambition, but I'm also not saying that you should sacrifice and try to, like, you know, force yourself to do things, good things for the world or something like that. I'm just saying that, like, that naturally flowed out of the free time I had was, say, connecting with others who were concerned about, like, because I was in New York when Hurricane Sandy hit, you know, and just devastated all of downtown Manhattan, including our building, which was, you know, out of power for 2 weeks and so on. So just the reality of climate change and connecting with others who are concerned about it and doing positive things just really feels good. Because then, you know, like Henry David Thoreau once said, you know, he'll never dedicate his mental activities to the marketplace. Like, his inner sanctum of his mind is his. He'll donate his or give his the labor of his hands for money. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that you should completely divorce your intellect, your streams of income. That's probably possible today. Maybe it was more possible back in the 1800s. But I am saying at least reserve some of your mental space for the non-marketplace for you. And when that opens up, it's just beautiful what happens.
This might be a good time to give our listeners some tips, especially listeners who are living in big, bustling, fast, impatient cities. You've talked already about seeking out urban sanctuaries as one way of inoculating yourself against the virus of hurry when you live in a big city. What were some of the other slow hacks or slow tips that you used? I know you talked about cultivating anticipation, smart filtering, the third story challenge. Could you walk us through some of those so people have some ideas to take away?
Right. So, you know, smart filtering is not letting every single ad you see kind of come into your consciousness, just sort of let it be kind of background color or something, and don't absorb every stimulus in the city. It's just more of like a meditative practice. The other one is looking up. So I call it third story awareness, where when you're going through Manhattan or London or Tokyo, just kind of have part of your perception up at the third story. Maybe you'll see like the trees in the wind, or like a gleam of light on a baby grand piano through a window or something like that. Like, these are beautiful sights that you'll never notice at street level, which is very commercial. So that's another thing, is third story living.
You talked about cultivating anticipation as well?
Right. So psychologists say that, you know, we actually get a lot of pleasure and joy, not out of actually satisfying a desire, but out of anticipating, oh, this is going to happen. So I thought, well, why not stretch that anticipation out? So if there's a restaurant you really want to go to, don't go right away. Maybe wait a while, a couple of weeks, let the anticipation build, you know, talk with your partner about it and so on. And then when you go and you have your slow food there, it's that much more delicious and enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. The joys of delayed gratification. I'm wondering if, looking back now on your time living slow in New York, if you were to roll the clock back and start again, is there anything you'd do differently?
Well, you know, there was definitely a big learning curve. A lot of psychologists say you shouldn't do things too drastically because we like to kind of make slow incremental changes. And in some ways, this was like a big change. But I think for me, I like to have big changes and shake things up. You know, this idea of sort of life hacking with soul, like you see all these big problems in the world and so on, but then you just like hack into your own life and say, what can I do differently? So I don't know if I would really change anything, quite frankly, because even though there were periods of, my God, what am I doing? You know, when I was sitting on this park bench or something like that, when I could be doing more effective or more directed towards my career, you know, in the end, it all came down to a learning experience, quite an enjoyable one.
Did you experience much pushback or mockery from friends and colleagues and family?
Well, people were wondering kind of, why are you doing this? And also there was a certain amount of jealousy because people were still going to the office. Mm-hmm. I had friends who were investment bankers or, you know, who work very long hours, and they were a little bit jealous that I was body surfing in the Rockaways or stuff like that in New York City that they weren't doing. Of course, it's as natural. Mm-hmm. And with my wife, you know, because she had this high-powered job at the UN, she worked at UN Women as a program specialist, she also sometimes had to work really long hours. So oftentimes that led to some conflict in our relationship.
Towards the end of the book, you spend some time describing a trip you made to Morocco. which had all kinds of slow travel vibe. Do you feel that that was essential to leave New York City to get some kind of perspective and clarity on what you were doing?
Right. So when I was in Morocco, and I went there for a conference that I was speaking at, but then ended up doing this 2 weeks of slow travel around the country, it definitely opened me up to, you know, meeting this one Moroccan family, and they took me into their home, and it was basically like a 12 by 12 apartment, like sort of like our micro apartment in New York, you know, but they had their whole big family in it, and they were living happily in it. And just the kind of simplicity and joy, and the fact that Morocco, the parts that I was in, weren't really affected by the global sort of capitalist juggernaut of you have to always be working, consuming, and so on. So there was this extended family, you know, people are people through other people type of sense that I got there. And I think it did really give a lot of perspective on what I was thinking about doing in New York. And of course, travel has the ability to do that if you're able to disconnect from having to totally be following a guidebook and routes and itineraries and so on. And you can just sink into the place where you are.
Mm-hmm. Now, you came back from Morocco, and then in the end, you left New York City, didn't you?
That's right. So, you know, we'd been in New York City for 5 years. And at the end, you know, of the book, my wife, she gets pregnant while we're in the micro apartment. And we just started picturing what it would be like to sort of have a baby in New York. And there's no real good birthing center. You know, we want to have like a natural birth and so on. So at a certain point in our life, we decided that we were going to fulfill a dream we had for a long time, which was to leave the city and move to a smaller town where we have a piece of property and build a house there and kind of settle in a smaller place.
Mm-hmm. But does that mean that people in similar circumstances cannot carry on in New York, or it just worked for you? I guess what I'm asking is it to live slow in the way that you did so successfully in New York City, is it something really you could only do if you're in your 20s, child without children, you know, maybe from a middle class background? Is it something really that you can only do if you have a certain amount of privilege at a certain point in your life, do you think?
Well, you know, it's something that I thought about a lot. And, you know, part of, I think, what I learned was that it's not possible for everyone to do what I did, because, you know, if you're just barely scraping by, it's difficult, obviously, to open up all this free time and leisure and so on, especially in such an expensive place like New York or San Francisco or, you know, whatever big city you're in. I would say, like, there's a couple things. Like, one is, you know, think long term. If you're kind of in a working class background, or you've got a lot of debt or something like that, you know, just sort of reanalyze how you deal with money. So it's like, look at your joy to stuff ratio, like how much pleasure are you getting out of each individual purchase, and see if you can pay yourself first, which means like whenever you get any money coming in, put aside immediately 10% or 20% into a savings account before paying your other bills. On a larger level, think in terms of like a 5 to 10 year plan of reskilling yourself and upskilling and seeing if you can find ways of having independent income, like income streams that are not tied to necessarily a full-time employer, while at the same time you're reducing your expenses. So it's more of a philosophical shift on an individual level. On a larger level, like societal, what I realize is that we really have to have big policy changes. Now, I'll just talk about the U.S. right now. But for example, you know, we have terrible paternity and maternity leave policies. That has to change. There has to be like more time available to be with kids. And the other thing is just having a single-payer healthcare system would be fantastic, because you know, this is the richest country in the world and the only one without a decent, you know, healthcare system. In a sense, it's like that would also allow you to be more independent and free and creative and self-paced if you're not just depending upon that full-time job to give you healthcare. And I think that's kind of a trap as well. And then other policies, like we need to definitely have more equity in the society. There's just vast differences in wealth in the U.S. And that's something that I really realized and felt. Just some more healthy redistribution of some of that income will also go a long way towards reducing kind of the sort of stress and anxiety and so on that comes out of this inequality.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things I enjoyed very much about your book, is that it's a deeply and movingly personal journey, but you never lose sight of the bigger picture. What you've just spoken of there reminds me of a line. There were several lines I wanted to read out, but I'm just going to read one, actually, so if you'll permit me to read your prose back to you now. This is for page 221. It's getting towards the end, and it goes like this. It strikes me that the grand theories that attempt to encapsulate the 21st century, from Barber's Jihad versus McWorld to Fukuyama's End of History, carry partial truths but miss the much subtler core pivot of our era. Our planet, our happiness, and our children's future depend upon finding equilibrium through cultivating the still, the small, the slow. You remember, right? I always find it uncomfortable having my lines read back to me. Perhaps you don't even remember writing that. But it echoes what you've just been saying there, in a sense, that there is the small, the personal, but there's also the bigger sweep of history that's going on, and we have to move forward, it seems to me, on both fronts, you're saying. Is that a fair interpretation?
That's true. And also that I think that this tension between the McWorlds or the one world uniplanets, or this kind of what, you know, Pope Francis recently called on his trip to the U.S., one-dimensional globalization, which is just like consumption and standardization. But there's a huge tension, I think, between that and texture or authenticity or hybrid culture, you know, the thousand types of ways of being human and so on, and not standardizing. So I think the slow food movements, you know, slow travel, the transition movements, all of these, like, sort of this great turning that we're in right now is, you know, what Paul Hawken called, you know, the 2 million NGOs and small citizen groups and so on that are part of this. It's almost like an antibody to the standardization, all of these kind of cells of resistance that are rising up. I think that, like, I found myself kind of living slowly in Manhattan, embedded in these countercultures. That's an untold story, but that's kind of the real resistance right now. It's almost like it's not jihad versus McWorld. It's really like, you know, this crazy, fast, standardized world versus people like now starting to say, wait a minute, being human is much different than what they're presenting it.
That sounds like a wonderful place to end. Is there one final thought you'd want to toss out towards any listener who's toying with the idea of going slow in his or her city?
Well, I would just say, you know, you don't have to do what my wife and I did and move into a tiny apartment and work, you know, 2 days a week. That's, you know, the idea of the book in some ways is to sort of ask you, like, what's your slow city? According to your personality and tastes and desires, what's a way that in this age of fast and more that you can find a slower, saner life that's more fit for the future and brings you more happiness?
Fabulous. That sounds like a wonderful prescription. Thank you so much, William Powers. The book is magnificent. It's called New Slow City. I urge everyone to go out and get a copy and read it. I won't say fast. I won't say slowly. I'll say read it at your own pace. Thanks again, Bill. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
It's been a pleasure for me too, Carl.